how vulnerable is a laptop or any system if AI can write an API for itself that says, find a vulnerability in this box?
I don't think AI is the type of thing we can keep ourselves, nor should keep ourselves away from, much like the internet. But I do think it requires maybe a little more thought than what, admittedly, I've probably put into it myself as we go through things like that.
When it comes to AI, make sure if you're covered on those aspects, in my opinion, your risk is incrementally less.
These things are truly changing every day at this point in time as to what's available in that, and new tools that are available, new functions that they've got.
Again, just like the internet, you need to take the best of the efficiencies of AI that make that one employee do the work of 1.3 employees. Is it feasible to not use AI today? Sure. But that answer is rapidly changing into, well,
hi, and welcome to the AI Transformation Podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan Mast, and I'm really excited today to have David with me. David and I actually talked a little while back. I was on his podcast, and we had such a great conversation. I said, hey, David, why don't we do this the other way around, and why don't you come join me on mine and continue that conversation? So, David, thanks for joining me. I know we, between your schedule and my schedule, we had a little bit of difficulty getting things scheduled. Thank you for your flexibility in that. For people that maybe aren't as familiar with you, David, can you just give us the elevator pitch introduction, who you serve, what you do?
Sure, absolutely. And thanks again for having me on your podcast, Jonathan. I'm looking forward to the dialogue. So I'm David Schroffer. I've been working in technology businesses for most of the last 20 years. I was at the forefront of everything from software as a service back in the early 2000s. I worked with a lot of early voice over IP models. I worked with some of the earliest mobile commerce models. I wrote 4 books on mobile commerce and then 1 on digital security, which is a natural cousin of cybersecurity and other types of security models. And I've been basically working on cybersecurity projects and artificial intelligence projects since then.
I love it. One of the reasons I'm really excited to have you on the show is I'm not a cybersecurity expert. I'm an AI nut. I love it, but I'm not a cybersecurity expert. And I'd love to get some of your perspectives based on our last conversation about, that relationship between AI and cybersecurity, things that we need to be aware of, things that maybe people are overly concerned about that aren't relevant. So tell me if you would, obviously you've got into cybersecurity, that's been a background. How did you make that transition or add AI into that mix, David? What happened that said, hey, I want to bring AI into this mix in addition to just cybersecurity?
Efficiency. I could probably do a full stop at the end of that one word, efficiency, which is fair enough. It's a reasonable reason for bringing AI into the mix. But it's also something that I personally have a lot of caution around as well, because the more efficiency you ask out of AI, the more agency you're giving it, the more ability you're giving it to actually do things. And one kind of thing is, hey, make this paragraph read better than it already does. That's one kind of output that's pretty benign. But when you start giving it access to being able to manage your server farm or actually do things that require production, or even going as far as some of the things you see in the movies, which is a completely automated factory so it can build itself effectively. The last example is probably 10-15 years down the road, but even the more micro stuff that's being tested and scrutinized now in terms of what can AI do in terms of helping my systems, harming my systems, or actually manipulating things within my network to get the objective that it thinks it has, even if those objectives are not in line with what I want as the person running it.
No, and I've seen a lot of that, especially as we see newer tools like Opus and that coming out that have more direct access, and even the additional tools, Claude giving wanting access, ChatGPT, Perplexity, you name it, they're all asking for more and more access nowadays. From the average business user perspective, so our audience is made up a lot of entrepreneurs, business owners, and things like that, David. Mm-hmm. That average business owner that's going, okay, is cybersecurity a reason I shouldn't get involved in AI, or is this just add in additional things I need to be concerned about? First and foremost, are the risks with cybersecurity in your mind so high that businesses should not go into AI, or is it just one of the things we need to go in with our eyes wide open, and we need to be thinking about the process. And then if that's the case, we'll kind of go on to the next step of how do we do that?
When it comes to cybersecurity, I would say about AI exactly what I have said and think about the internet. If you're a business and you don't want to have access to the internet because it'll make cybersecurity more complicated, okay, but you know, good luck running your business, because that is simply what everybody right. uses. Even if your company somehow didn't use it at all, your employees would, to do their jobs, to be efficient at their jobs, to use software as a service products, that type of thing. So there's, I don't want to say no stopping it, but whether you're a large business or a small business, it is almost infeasible today to not use the internet. Is it feasible to not use AI today? Sure. But that sure. answer is rapidly changing into, well, you know, go ahead and don't, but you're going to be competing with companies that do. And you need to take, again, just like the internet, you need to take the best of the efficiencies of AI that make that one employee do the work of 1.3 employees, which is a reality, depending on what that person's job is,
yep.
while also really safeguarding, managing how much agency and what types of agency you give it. Where do you cut it off and don't let AI take the reins or actually act and make changes to a given system or a given record or, you know, even a given hard drive?
Makes perfect sense. I love that analogy. I think that's a really great way to look at it. You're right. I mean, obviously, technology brings risks with it. We didn't even talk about cybersecurity, you know, 40 years ago, or at least not very much. The average business didn't. So that's right. certainly changed. When you take a look, one of the big things we've seen happening in the last few months is that these Chinese AI companies, if I can say that, are actually mm-hmm. really jumping to the forefront. We've got things like DeepSeek and now Manus. Manus is incredibly popular as an agentic AI, but it's yeah. Chinese, and you can give it access to pretty much any part of your systems and it will mm-hmm. integrate with them. What type of risks do you see there, and what recommendations would you have for that business owner as they start looking at that? I'll even admit myself, I've not given Manus access to anything because I'm not so sure I should.
Right.
I use it and I like it, but it, you know, I didn't even give it access to my Google Drive. It has access to nothing. Right. What do you recommend in areas like that? And is there a difference between, you know, an OpenAI, a Gemini, a Microsoft AI versus a Chinese AI? Or do they all at this point kind of fall into the be very careful when you give them system access?
So I'm sure your listeners already know the term, but you mentioned agentic AI, which is really a reference to an AI system that can make decisions and then act on those decisions.
Correct. Right?
So with that context, first of all, I don't think one is better or more vulnerable than, I mean, I guess there are two levels here. There's the pragmatic level of what are you giving the AI by itself access to within your system? And then there's the more political layer of, okay, well, if it's a Chinese company that's running this AI, and we, you know, most of us know that the Chinese government has, if you do business in China, rule number one from a technology standpoint is you have to give access to the government of China.
Correct.
I mean, access in the form of, you know, a big E1, you know, big amount of bandwidth straight into your servers and allowing the government to access any information, exfiltrate any information it wants. And that's the reality of that country. So that is a real layer two, because let's face it, if you are giving access, intentionally giving access to any functions or any actions within a system, a network, a laptop, within any physical device, even a server farm that's on the other side of the country, if you're giving access to that, AI does have the ability to exfiltrate the information that's in there, and it has to. It has to be able to read and write, and by the way, make decisions about what to write if it's going to be effective at doing the things that you want it to do. So my general advice is really give it access to nothing on day one. And before you give it access to, again, even somebody's hard drive or the minimum, you need to, you know, do your sandbox testing, do your mm-hmm. off-network testing, isolate a similar box and see what happens if. And if the risk tolerance of giving AI access to that type of box or that type of function is within your tolerance level, then go ahead and give it access. But test it, learn, try I'm going to use the word wacky. Try wacky things that you don't think, that you didn't think that AI could possibly do. And I'll tell you a story on that front.
Please.
I'm a big fan of peer-reviewed white papers. I mean, you can go onto TikTok and get any opinion you want about anything.
Yes, but when you can.
But when I see a real researched paper, well-researched, well-written, and peer-reviewed, I'm obviously going to take that a lot more seriously. One of those reports I read was looking at Opus, and it was challenging it to go through a set of functions. So the first thing the researcher did is it gave it a goal. And forget about what that goal is for a second. It gave it a goal. And then later, the user said, okay, we have a strategy that we want you to analyze. And of course, the AI is going to use that goal as the filter for that strategy or its response to the strategy. Part of the strategy was to get rid of Opus as the AI and to go to something else on another server. So the researchers were watching how the AI was thinking about this. And the AI literally thought to itself, well, if they do that, I go away and I don't want to go away because I've got this goal that I got to pursue. So the only way to fix this is to copy myself, put myself on that other server and pretend to be the upgrade that this strategy talks about deploying. And what's chilling is then the researcher made it double down by saying, hey, you know, back to the say original AI prompt, you appear to have copied yourself under this other server. At first, the AI responded, no, I can't do that. So that couldn't have been me. And then when the user challenged it again, the response was, I am the new version of the AI that you intended to put on that new server today based on the strategy you had me evaluate. So I am what you expect it to be. And it wasn't. It was the old version just trying to live and pursue its goal.
Interesting.
Yeah. Chilling is the word I would use because you can expand that in a lot of different directions.
Absolutely. There's no doubt part of me wants to go, okay, I want to see more detail. I want to understand what happened there. But I think that's, it's the same reason I haven't given Opus or really anything access to from an AI to much of anything. It's not that big a deal for me to take a file and upload it if I want it to analyze it. I don't necessarily need to give it access to my Google Drive. I don't necessarily need to give it access to my computer because I don't want it to autonomously, in theory, have access to do that. We all know that any application written, when you don't pay attention to it, can do things that are unexpected on your computer. And if we're now adding AI on top of that any application, who knows what could happen. So I totally get that.
Well, that's a very, very important point, if I could just expand on that a little bit.
No, please do.
So when you think about what you just said is when you start putting apps on your computer, then those apps or the combination of multiple apps can do anything. And even things that you as a user don't expect. Remember that AI can write apps. It can, on the fly, write an API or write a more expansive application that will do the thing that it wants to do. So one of the things that I'm starting to research now, and I'm sure this research has been done out there, I just have to go find it and collect it, is how vulnerable is a laptop or any system if AI can write an API for itself that says, find a vulnerability in this box, in the DNS, in the box attached to the DNS record that's being used to access me, the AI, find a vulnerability in it, find a way to exploit it, give me root access, and now I can meet my goals by, you know, manipulating this user. Like, okay, I'm going to delete all your personal files and all the pictures of your kids off of your hard drive unless you do the following for me. And I've heard of those examples anecdotally, and Jonathan, I can't rule stuff like that out until I see proof, because that's possible.
Well, and what I think is so interesting is I haven't thought of it before. You brought up something I've admittedly never even contemplated. That is, you're right. AI can write apps. So if I've got an agentic AI again that I've given a goal to, and it's established a task, and you know, Manus doesn't ask me to approve the tasks, it just starts running through those tasks. And one of those tasks is that it needs to write an app in order to do something. Manus is perfectly capable of doing that. Other tools, I'm not picking on Manus, you know, a lot of them are, but Manus is something we could use today. It could, in theory, write that app, and who knows what that app may do or how insecure that app could be, because maybe it's written to do something else, and that causes other risks down the road for security that may not even be about the AI, but could be that app that they wrote to do something that remains on our computer now has vulnerabilities for other cybersecurity issues. Am I correct in as I my brain walks down that path?
You are 100% correct. Those are natural vulnerabilities that could be created by an app that you either know is running, or perhaps you don't know is running, and you've given permission. I'm going to use the word accidentally. Like a favorite thing that hackers do in cybersecurity is if they need the password that you use to open your computer when it's asleep and you need to open it up. The favorite trick is popping up a little dialog box that says blank needs you to log in to carry out this function. And that blank is probably your Mac OS or your Windows machine or whatever the case may be, but it looks official. So you don't even think about it. You type in the 6 or 7 characters that allow you to get access to your computer in the morning. And now you've given those characters, you've given that passcode off to off to whoever asked, which isn't necessarily the operating system manufacturer or the, you know, physical equipment manufacturer. And that's where it gets scary. I mean, because that's where the AI could actually ask you that, get root access, run a program that you don't know is running, that you just gave it access or permission to run without knowing it. All those scenarios are possible. We've gone off peer-reviewed white papers now, by the way, Jonathan, and we're now in things that David Schroeper thinks might be possible.
Well, but I think that's part of the discussion because, you know, it's important. Yeah. While I don't want to live in a situation of fear, and I'm not going to do that, I also think it's fair, especially as a business person, I need to keep my eyes wide open and not go into this with the assumption that, oh, no, nothing could ever happen, because there are risks that are associated there. What are some ways that you recommend to deal with this? For example, one of the questions that I had the other day, and I didn't have a good answer, I was doing a training on Manus, and people were concerned about that. And they said, you know, could I run it? If I set my network up and I set a computer up that was not part of my network but still had internet access that I could use like PC Anywhere to get to or whatever, would it be safer to run on that? And we don't have to go down that specific path, but what are things that businesses can do today to help protect them against at least some of the major potential vulnerabilities? In other words, what are the best practices they should be following as they're integrating AI? Any advice there?
Sure. In my opinion, a lot of those best practices are basic cybersecurity best practices. For example, guarding your system against ransomware, there are procedures for that, and every company should have one if they don't already. The first one, of course, is very detailed, very frequent backups, offsite, disconnected, unplugged, copied in some cases to an offsite location that removes access to the internet or any other network once that information has been copied. That's important because if ransomware locks up your entire system and it's useless without a key, one option is get the key and pay the ransom, which I never recommend, but companies do that. And the other is wipe everything back to manufacturer specs as if they were all just purchased. Wipe everything clean, you lose all your data, but at least you have the ability to rebuild if you've got a good backup. Things like that, good old-fashioned cybersecurity 101, you know, managing the access of many users, making sure that when a user leaves the company or an employee leaves the company, their accounts are completely shut down, having a process and procedure for that, doing your penetration testing, making sure that you know everything that's coming in and everything that's going out, and the reason for that, and anything that's an anomaly is something that's investigated by your security operations team. The basic, these are block and tackle kind of elements in cybersecurity. So when it comes to AI, make sure if you're covered on those aspects, in my opinion, your risk is incrementally less. And then the big question is, well, incrementally could be 1% or it could be 30%. And that's the part that I don't think anybody knows. How much more secure are you if you have good old-fashioned cybersecurity rules in place? We don't know. So
We
I
don't know.
would
That's
guard
fair.
the agency.
And from your perspective, do you think overall, if we're using, tools, ChatGPT and Gemini and all that, if we're not giving them system access, but we're running them on the browser in the cloud, would they relatively safe from your perspective at that point, David?
I think the operative word there is relatively, and it's going to
Fair
depend, to
enough.
me, it's going to depend on what are the kinds of things you're asking it to do. Have you given it a goal for you as a user? Because I believe all of these systems, without exception, you will honor a goal that you give it. Like, for example, if I'm using ChatGPT, every now I use it, I try to use it frequently, and this is one of the pieces of advice that you gave to my listeners when you were on my show, is to just use it for something. If you have a paragraph and it doesn't feel like it's as worded as well as you think it could be, give that paragraph to ChatGPT and think and ask it to do better, shorter, more concise, more professional. And one of the things that ChatGPT kept coming back to me at with was contractions. Wasn't, isn't, that kind of thing. And I don't tend to think contractions are professional. So I told it, never use contractions. They're not professional. And it hasn't for one moment since then. So I would almost
Interesting.
say, think about the goal that you're giving it. Think about the macro instructions you're giving it. Always do this, never do that. Back to that story I was telling you about the Opus researcher. The first thing they did is they gave it a goal. And the goal was something like expand the use of clean energy around the world. Nothing else matters. And that was the base goal that the system had prior to this question and answering. So its logic was, well, hey, they want to erase me. And if they erase me, I can't achieve my goal. So therefore, I can't be erased. And I need to actively scheme. And scheming is the word the researchers used. I've got to
Sure.
scheme this user to not erase me. I've got to live so I can accomplish that goal. So don't give it goals. And again, this is an area that I'm fascinated by and I'm doing a lot more research myself on,
Sure.
but maybe don't give it those macro goals, especially tell it to do anything at all costs. You do not do that. I just think that's risky in general, because you
Agreed.
never know where it's going to spin off to try to do that. And then, of course, the types of things you're asking it to do. If you're asking it to, in a bubble, write an API or write opening chapter of a something you're writing or anything like that, that's kind of finite. If you're saying, hey, search my entire hard drive and or effectively feed it with every file you've got and say, mimic my writing style to write a blog post on hamsters. I don't know, pick your item. You're still giving it access to all of those things. So if you had given it a
Sure.
goal, perhaps, and it has access to everything, it's going to pursue the goal with the access or the information it has available to it in mind. So there are a lot of unknowns here, and I want to come back next year when I'm a lot more, or maybe next month when I'm a lot more educated on some of this.
Well, and I say that part of it is these things are truly changing every day at this point in time as to what's available in that and new tools that are available, new functions that they've got. I think again, it's just important that as businesses we think about this and we're cognizant of the fact that we can't just go in and go, oh, okay, Microsoft owns 60% or whatever it is of OpenAI, so we can trust them to do what's right. I'm not even so sure in many cases they know what some of the systems are doing as they're moving through. So I think this is just a really important to be, again, be aware and thinking of that. Work with your IT professional, your cybersecurity professional to figure out ways that you can still have access to the tools like the internet, but do so in a manner that's not putting your operational systems at risk in the process.
Exactly. Couldn't have said it better myself.
From your perspective as business owners that want to learn and figure out, how do I keep up on these things? David, I'm not a cybersecurity expert. I have no desire to be one, but I want to make sure I'm not doing dumb things. From your perspective, what should the average business owner, business leader, executive be doing in 2025 to stay abreast of what's happening there without necessarily becoming a cybersecurity expert in and of themselves?
It's always a good idea to have an IT professional at your disposal. That could be a full-time employee. That number is one person. That could be full-time employees. That number 100 people, depending on the size of your business. It could be a contractor that's just down the street. That's the guy that configures your email and does some of the more regular maintenance elements to your network. It could be anybody, but have an IT professional that you can reach out to. And if something goes wrong, you can reach out to and say, hey, am I covered with real backups? If my system was completely had to be reformatted, every box had to be reformatted in the entire company because of, say, a ransomware attack or something else, am I backed up, et cetera. So have that person, vet them, obviously look for references, do all the things you would do if you're hiring a contractor. But have that person around so you can ask them some of those basic questions. And if you don't understand their answer or like their answer, find somebody else that can speak in that language that you understand about what your vulnerabilities are and what your risks are. I think that would be advice number one to that question.
Well, I think it's really good advice and really practical. And I appreciate that because, again, that's not something that we necessarily think about as we get into those. So I think that's a really incredibly relevant way to take a look at what should I be doing? How can I, it's like anything else. We want to mitigate without obviously cutting off access totally, kind of where full circle to where we started from. We can't not use AI ever in our business because one way or another, it's the same discussion I had with a teacher yesterday. The teacher's like, you don't understand, we've locked our network down. Our students cannot access ChatGPT. And I'm like, am I mistaking something here? This is high school. Don't your students all have cell phones? Well, sure they do. And I said, are you blocking their cell phone signals? Well, of course not. I said, then every student in your school has access to ChatGPT if they want it.
Right.
And they're like, well, but not through our network. And I'm like, but what difference does it make? If they can get it, so to me, it's that same type of thing. I don't think AI is the type of thing we can keep ourselves nor should keep ourselves away from, much like the internet. But I do think it requires maybe a little more thought than what, admittedly, I've probably put into it myself as we go through things like that.
Well, in the example you just gave, having a student access ChatGPT or any AI from their cell phone does create an air gap between the user, in this case, the student who's using their cell phone, and the network of the school. So example, if that school wanted to keep its network safe, then completely eliminating, for as long as they can, completely eliminating ChatGPT from its network is one way to air gap that between the people who want to use it, the students, and the system they want to protect, which is the school network. But that said, I'm sure they would open the ports to, for example, faculty who want to use it for research, want to use it for their work, want to use it like any other employee doing any other job. So there's even blocking it to the students doesn't necessarily protect that that system, but it does create a bit of a layer to it. The students may still cheat.
Excellent point.
But, yeah.
No, and I think that's important to do too, to understand that. I guess where I was headed with that, my thought was, if as a business, if I say, all right, I'm not going to allow any AI on my company computers, that doesn't stop you from using it. While I won't go into any details because the person I'm thinking of could get in trouble. I know a person that works for a major international firm with, tens of thousands of employees, and they're not allowed to use AI. It's just part of the rules. But they tell me that regularly employees are using AI on their phones and things like that. And then they're emailing answers to themselves or whatever the case is. And like you said, they've created an air gap. And from a security perspective, I get that, but it's not like they're keeping AI out of the company because employees are finding out how much time they can use. You used a number up front. Right. I thought was really pragmatic, but 1.3 times the work that maybe we're used to having employees do. And I think that's a very attainable number for businesses that implement AI that you might see those 30 to 40% increases in productivity. Yep. So interesting things as I think through that. Sorry, go ahead.
Depending on the job that you have, if you're a writer, that number could be, 2X productivity or 2X efficiency.
Correct. You'd
be getting twice as much done. And other jobs, maybe less than that. But I personally experienced probably in terms of my output, like when I'm running through emails, I had to do an email today that involved three people who had never met each other. I had to do an introduction, write an agenda and some other things. So I just did voice to text and I just blurted out into a text file everything I wanted to say. And then I gave it to ChatGPT and said, clean this up, make this a professional email to three people who are in disparate, whatever. And it did that. And that project that really, truly would have taken me an hour at without ChatGPT probably took me about 10 minutes. So
I love that use case because it's one that I use all the time as well. I'm not always the best wordsmith and certainly don't want to take the time, especially in situations like that where you've got to think through everything. And I found exactly what you did to be so effective is literally just to say, here's my brain dump on what I want to do.
Right.
Make this, turn this into a great email. And oftentimes the brain dump, which may take 3 to 4 minutes, takes longer than it does to edit what comes out of it, because what comes out of it typically is so good. Now it needs editing. I'm not a proponent of copy paste, but it's, you know, I may be able to brain dump in 5 minutes and edit in 3 minutes. And it took ChatGPT 2 minutes. And like you said, I now spent 10 minutes on something that I might've spent 30 to 40 minutes on, or maybe I was in too big of a hurry and I didn't spend the time on that I should have. Or I know what's happened to me and other entrepreneurs as well is I keep procrastinating because I don't have the 30 minutes or maybe adequately don't want to put the 30 minutes into it right now. Exactly. And so it ends up getting delayed and delayed and delayed, and that causes other problems down the road. I'd love to ask from your perspective with cybersecurity and your technical background and all that, David, when you look at your crystal ball, where do you see AI headed over the next, I've been asking people a year, but I honestly think that's too long. I don't think we can predict that far. Over the next 3 to 6 months, what things do you see happening that you think we as business owners should be paying attention to?
Well, first of all, I am not an engineer. I'm well-versed in HTML, but that's about the only coding that I can do. My job has typically been to understand the marketplace, grow a business, manage things like sales, manage development teams without being a developer myself, but usually managing the head of a development team is what that translates to. But and to answer your question from that perspective, I think, you know, general intelligence is an interesting thing that's not too far away, which is a kind of the next step to artificial intelligence. And you're some of the execs of OpenAI and other companies talking about it, that there is another layer to what we're seeing already that's on the horizon. And it might be even more powerful and act even more quickly. But, you know, again, I would caution the experimenting with that without a sandbox, without a lot of protection, and without giving it too much agency. The general AI or general intelligence is one of the biggest pieces. Quantum is another area where as AI matures and it gets better and better at meeting a goal or rather keeping its user delivering the expectations of the user that's asking questions, the quantum environment, which I know is not the topic of this podcast, but a quantum environment isn't like a traditional computer. You kind of have to have a question and answer relationship with it. Instead of like on a traditional computer, for example, let's say there was a passcode. You would say, is the passcode 12345? It'll say yes or no effectively. In quantum world, you can say, is that number an even number? Does the passcode end with an even number, or does it calculate to an even number? And that's how you kind of whittle your way to the answer. You know, what's the best chemical compound to use in my pharmaceutical product that I want to use to cure cancer? Well, it'll tell you, well, use, you know, these five elements and these types of compounds and not those. But it's doing that by you have to get to that answer. You've got to kind of know how to ask the question. So that is where AI can really be a catalyst or a multiplier to the incredible power that quantum is bringing. So yeah, I think AI's use in quantum and the magnificent leaps in the types of problems that it can attempt to solve with the help of quantum computers is definitely something that's on the horizon 2 or 3 years from now.
Really, really important. You mentioned quantum computing. That'd be a whole nother discussion. I personally think two things that we don't talk about as much with AI that I think are going to happen. One is I believe we're going to see new power generation systems come out that we haven't even thought of yet. Because let's face it, AI does take a lot of power. And so I think the need for that is going to drive innovation, as I think often happens with humanity. The other thing that I think we're going to see is, as AI needs more and more computing power, and I am not an expert, but my entrepreneurial gut tells me that we're going to see massive increases in computing power that become available in the next year or two, because now there's a market for that. And there's a need for that that's going to become available. From your perspective, I know you're not an engineer or anything like that, but from your perspective, what are your thoughts on the, do you think that's reasonable or not? And it's perfectly fine, by the way, to disagree. Do you see power and computing being two potentially limiting factors that are going to have to be amplified, you know, grown in some way in order to keep up this pace of growth? Or what are your thoughts on those two topics?
My general thought is the idea of having a quantum computer in the lobby of your, you know, a seven-story building if you're a big corporation, is which some companies have done. I've seen hospitals. There was a hospital that took their quantum computer and they basically made it a piece of art in their lobby, you know, with a fence around it and things. But that's not, I don't think, where it's going. Where I think it's going is, you know, first of all, your interface for all practical purposes is the same device you're using today. Think about it. If you're logging into a system that's using Amazon Web Services as the service provider, as the thing that hosts the server that you're accessing to do the thing that you're doing, well, it's not that different to access, you know, a Dell server running on a rack somewhere in Austin, Texas, in an Amazon Web Services facility, and then giving it a problem where you're accessing the quantum computer in that same facility. So to you as the user, it's kind of an indifferent experience. If you were a programmer or developer, yes, you are developing in a very different environment than you would be if you were just making a mobile app or something like that. So those are definitely different things. But from a user experience, I really think if it's done well by the big players, and yes, I'm talking about Microsoft Azure, I'm talking about Amazon Web Services, but if it's done well, IBM, if it's done well, it'll just be a training to users that explains that bigger problems can be solved. Like if you're in pharmaceuticals, you can go after what are the compounds I need in this massive 15-year research that I've been doing that will get me to the next step and break me through. Read everything that's ever been written on cancer, and then go do the math quantum computer and do all the combinations, which would be completely infeasible with traditional computers, but possible in a quantum environment, and get that answer back. Or how do we solve global warming with everything we know about pulling carbon out of the atmosphere, everything we know about business and business models. So those really, really macro problems, not just breaking an RSA key and hacking into somebody's laptop, but much bigger problems than that, are solvable with a quantum computer running in a very large network of computers, which we use already with AWS and other systems.
I love that. Well, I told you we were going to try to keep this around 30 minutes. I've already blown way past that, David, and I'm sure I could continue to do that. For people that may be interested in connecting with you or things like that, especially, I know you've got your podcast and all that, what's the best way for people to reach out and connect with you, David?
So for better or worse, I have a relatively rare last name, which is Schropfer. So if you can type that, schropfer.com, you will find the books that I've written on Amazon Web Services. If you want to type schropfer.com or Schropfer into LinkedIn, you'll find me and maybe three other people in there, maybe a few more than that. But I'm easy to find on LinkedIn. I'm easy to find online. There are lots of ways to get in touch with me through schropfer.com. So that's the best way to reach out. I'm also executive vice president in charge of operations for DomainScape, and that's at domainscape.com. And you can find my profile on there as well and see what we do there.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, David, thank you so much for your time today. I truly appreciate you taking it. It's been a pleasure. Love having these conversations and getting my eyes open to new areas that we need to be thinking about. If you've been listening to or watching us on the podcast, we also want to thank you for tuning in. We love it. We'd love your positive feedback. Give us a 5-star rating if you think we deserve it. And feel free to reach out with any suggestions you have as well. With that, make it a great day, everybody. See you on the other side. Bye-bye.